head and co-writer of Into Deep, which was a Freddie Award finalist for writing excellence. Under his alter ego, William J. Anderson, he is a poet, essayist, and dedicated force in the Twin Cities literary community. He founded the Cracked Walnut Writing Collective, the Fifth Wednesday Reading Series at Merriam Park Library, and the Blank Verse Reading Series at North Twin Library. His work has appeared in Dark Side of the Loon, a Twin Cities Sisters of Crime anthology series, and Turning Points, a collection of essays and activism. Whether writing thrillers, poetry, or essays, A.W. Powers, or William J. Anderson is always exploring the boundaries of storytelling. He lives and writes in the northwest suburb of Minneapolis, still accepting that he knows very little, but having a great time trying to figure it all out. As an intensely curious person myself, I have lots of questions, and maybe you do too. Write them down, we'll hold them to the end. Now please join me in giving Bill and Natalie a warm welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yes.
We decided we were going to do a conversation tonight. But of course, we have to be difficult. So we're going to start off with some questions. How many of you are psychic? Raise your hand. How many of you knew I was going to ask that question? And refused as a result? How many of you believe in ghosts? Oh, spirits, yes. I do not make a distinction between ghosts and spirits. They're all from the other side. They're all beyond me. So I know some people do, but I don't.
And I do, so we can talk about that.
Okay, good.
I have a question. How many of you in here would say that you're intuitive? Okay, so a few more hands with that. So what I want to do next is actually read the definition in Webster's about intuition. So the definition of intuition in Webster's dictionary says, the power or faculty of obtaining to direct knowledge or cognition without evident rational thought and inference. Immediate apprehension or cognition, knowledge or conviction gained by intuition. So I kind of interpret that as getting information without having something directly in front of you, which actually is psychic. So if you call yourself at all intuitive, then you also get to call yourself psychic.
41% of the population believes in ESP. 37% believe in haunted houses. How many of you have visited a haunted house? Cool. I love that. Only 32% of us believe in ghosts. I don't believe that at all, but myself. When I'm doing a table someplace, I start off with the question. I try to trap everybody who walks by my table. Like I should have just said it to her as she walked by. I say, "Do you believe in ghosts?" And a lot of people will stop and talk to me, and we'll trade stories, and I'll tell them about the books. But I have some that will just go, "No." And then they will stand there and tell me about all of their ghosts in their life. Yeah. It's like, how can you not like ghost stories? You're living them. And it's fascinating to me.
Yep. And I think that when I'm out and about, I'm always amazed at the people. They'll find out what I write. They'll find out that I write about ghosts and ghost stories. And then everyone will come up to me on the sly and want to tell me their story about something that happened to them. Because I think we all have one. There's always things in our lives that you can't fully explain, or something interesting or unexplainable has happened.
Okay. I mentioned the fact that in my series came out of my nightmares. 8 books have been published. Book 9 is supposed to be into my publisher this Thursday. I'm in trouble. But it originated in my nightmares. And they were intense. They were scary. They're why I don't watch scary movies, because nobody makes a movie as scary as my nightmares. So I turned them into this character and into the series, and it's been therapeutic. And it honestly has. I can tell when I'm not writing enough because my nightmares will get worse. They'll flare back up and get ugly. One of the things that happened in the first book, I based it on, there's a scene in there where they see a ghost. And I based that scene on the ghost we had in our house in North Minneapolis. I walked in the door and she was sitting in the chair. She didn't stay. She didn't talk. I did see her twice, so I'm convinced I did see her. But yeah, so I was able to adapt that and bring it into the story. Easy to find material for me. What about you? Do you?
So let's see. So I actually believe that I saw a ghost one time when I was in college. I mean, I've seen a lot of ghosts since, but the first time that I can actually point to and say I saw a ghost, I was in college and I was working at a supper club in Excelsior called T Rights. It's an old supper club that served the prime rib dinners, and they had a old school dining room on one side, and that's where all the 80-year-old waitresses worked because they would never give up their Friday night or Saturday night shift for their prime rib tables. And the other side was the saloon, and I worked in the bar. I was in college, and one of the reasons I took that job was because when I came home from college, I actually had a curfew, like I did when I was in high school. I was the oldest daughter, so I had to. It was hard to wrap your head around that, having been at college. But if I worked in a bar, I could come home whenever I wanted. So I worked around the curfew that way. I would work most Friday, Saturday nights all through the summer. And when you work in a restaurant, your coworkers become your family. And it's your social circle because you're all working when everybody else is having fun. And so it becomes your family and your social group for the summer. And there's a hierarchy too. You've got the older dining room waitresses that won't give up those precious prime rib shifts. And then you've got the newbie waitresses that are all banished to the bar. And you've got the bartenders, you've got the barbacks, you've got the bussers, and then you have the whole cook line. And the cook line has its own order of hierarchy, who's allowed to work on what. And so this whole big functioning restaurant was just my summer. There was one night where one of the cooks, his name was Phil, and Phil had, he was just this crazy personality. He would always have the jokes on the cook line. He was always making fun of somebody or something. And he was just one of those people that was so fun to be around. And he was out there and they were having drinks, and they decided that after they were done at Tea Rights, they were going to head out and go out on Lake Minnetonka. And they were going to get in canoe and go out on the lake and finish their party with a six pack or whatever. So the next day I was coming in for the lunch shift, and the emergency vehicles were all piled up, and it was down to one lane traffic so I was late to work, stressed out coming in, and also you just knew something had happened on the lake. Well, I get into work and here it turns out that Phil and his buddy tipped over their canoe and he didn't know how to swim. He didn't make it. So the funeral followed sometime that week. And so things were kind of picking up and we're getting back into a normal swing a couple weeks later. And the thing about Phil is he always wore these black and white whorehound checkered polyester pants because back then it was the only fabric. They would buy all the cooks would buy their pants at the vintage shops because it was the only thing that was fire retardant, and it would wick away moisture. So if you got sweaty, they were comfortable to work in. And he always wore the same black and white whorehound pants. And I was in the middle of a busy, busy dinner rush, and I got really mad because one of my tables ordered hot fudge sundaes. And as a waitress in the middle of a really busy dinner rush, that's a death wish right there, because the second you walk out of the kitchen with a whole table of hot fudge sundaes, every other table around you is going to want the same thing, and it takes a lot of time to scoop that hard ice cream out of the freezer when it's been sitting there all week. So I'm scraping, trying to get the ice cream, and I just felt, it was just one of those really busy nights, and I just felt like somebody was watching me, and I looked over to the side, and there was Phil standing at the edge of the kitchen where the waitresses from the bar come in and out. And he had this big grin on his face. And I look over and the first thing that registered in my brain was, why aren't you behind the line? Like, the first thing I noticed was that he was in the wrong spot. Like, he never stood there. The cooks would come and go from the back of the kitchen. So they were never out in front of the cook line. And his black and white pants were all there, and he just had this grin. And later I realized it was because in that one particular spot, he could see everyone in the entire restaurant. He would have been able to look out and see the bartenders and everybody working in the pub. He would have seen the dining room waitresses coming and going from the other side of the kitchen and all the cooks. As I go back to digging my ice cream, I remembered that he was dead. And I look up again and he was gone. I am fully convinced that Phil was coming back that night just to let everyone know that he was okay and just say goodbye. So,
has Phil made it into one of your books?
He has not. No. Okay.
We'll be back for more Masters of Mystery after a word from our sponsors. Potato chips, kettle chips, ripple chips, or maybe popcorn, or puffcorn, or pretzels. Old Dutch makes them, and a whole lot more. Your snack cravings can be satisfied by grabbing a bag, box, or jar of your favorite at your favorite store. Just look for the Old Dutch windmill. Old Dutch is a Minnesota-made, family-owned company committed to quality and flavor that brings everyone together. Whether you're enjoying a holiday gathering or lounging at the beach, Old Dutch snacks make every moment special. Old Dutch. Quality lives here. Welcome back. It's time to rejoin Masters of Mystery.
Natalie and I actually met at the Love is Murder conference in Chicago.
Yes. We had to go to Chicago to meet each other.
It's pretty wild. I did a couple pitches at that conference, and I really didn't know anything when I started this whole process. My hero grows up to be a private investigator. Therefore, I'm writing mysteries because that's what private investigators do. But he sees, he experiences ghosts, has nightmares, sees all these horrible things. So it must be a mystery with a touch of horror. And I go to the conference there and I find out that what I'm actually writing are thrillers because I know who did it. Most of the time. So, and then somebody else told me, it's not really horror, it's paranormal. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's fine. But at that conference, I pitched it to a couple of agents, and I sat down, and it was still a mystery with a touch of horror at this point. And one of them said, horror, we're done talking. I'm like, it's just a touch, just a little bit. And there's no interest in that. So then another one let me talk a little bit, and I talk about the fact that in the first book, he's 13 years old, and she's like, so it's a young adult? I'm like, no, I wrote this intending to scare the crap out of grown-ups. And she's like, you can't have a 13-year-old protagonist. I'm like, well, Stephen King does, and I started listing them all off, and she's like, no, you can't do that. Fine, I'll go home. So that's kind of what happened there. You've also published an assortment of short stories. Do you find nonfiction easy to write, and are short stories easier for you than novels?
Novels? Yes, well, the short stories are part of the anthologies. The Sisters in Crime anthologies are fabulous, and I love, those are just fun. I just love turning in stories for those because it's a blind submission. And the last one especially, all the different things. There were rules. We had rules for the last one where you had to incorporate, I think it was a list of seven or eight or nine, eight?
It was eight, yeah.
Eight things, and you had to pick three of those, and I'm an overachiever, so I did all of them.
I did.
You had to have smoke, a twins baseball hat. All these things had to appear in your story in some way, shape, or form. A shovel.
Named Sandy.
A character named Sandy, yep. What else? Oh, yeah. So it's the Dark and Stormy Night anthology. And your first line of the story had to be, it was a dark and stormy night. And so it was just so fun to write with rules like that. And then the other one, where history meets mystery, The Dark Side of the Loon, that one, I had written a character in my second book for my mystery, paranormal mystery. I was so excited to write. I'm fascinated with the gangster history in St. Paul. So my ghost in the second book is a gangster that doesn't know that he's dead, and he decides to follow my main character home and decides that her apartment is his perfect new hideout. I had so much fun with that. I did so much research on gangsters and the gangsters in St. Paul. And so when this anthology came out with the premise that you had to write about something that actually happened, it was fair game to write about all the gangster stuff in St. Paul. So I actually used my same characters. In my story, they're ghosts. But in that story, it actually takes place during his time. So I had just a lot of fun. So I don't really necessarily set out to write short stories, but if there's a purpose, then I'm all in to do that.
I find lots of reasons to write short stories that don't stay that way. I did contribute to Dark Side of the Loon, Barbara Deese over there, and I both grew up in Anoka, and we both used the Anoka tornado of Father's Day 1939 as the backdrop in our story. Is there a better way to hide a murder than absolute destruction around it? It made perfect sense to me. But most of the time, I'll start off with a short story where we'll have a concept like what you described on Dark and Stormy Night, which I did write a story for that and didn't get in.
I didn't get into the second one because... And I didn't get into the second one because it was mine was too horror. I took too many liberties with the genre.
Well, you know, and by the time I wrote that, it was kind of, it has to be... It can't be, we can't recognize a character. You have to make sure we don't recognize a character. Well, it turns out that the actual short story that I wrote in there is a John Thompson story. John is the sidekick in the Psychic Guardian Angel series. So I wrote the story and I had to change the name because, it had to be, nobody could recognize it. And I'm like, man, there's a chance one of those judges might have read one of my books and then they'll recognize the name and I'll get thrown out no matter what.
See, mine weren't published yet, so I didn't have that problem.
So it's kind of like, well, they didn't publish it. That's fine. It's a good collection, the wonderful group of authors. But I still have the story that I can do something else for. Mm-hmm. My problem with short stories is I'll write it, and I'll look at it and go, that's a really good chapter one. And then we're off.
And one of the reasons I like short stories is because one of the hardest things for me when I'm writing a full manuscript is what I call the muddy middle. Like you start writing and you get really excited to get your characters out on the paper and they come alive. And so that's just a really fun process to see them be born. And then I often know, and you could read a million books on how to write a mystery novel, and every single one is going to be different because you really don't know how you're going to write a book until you actually sit down to do it. One of my favorite authors, Elizabeth George, has a chapter in her How to Write a Mystery Book, and it's called Bum Glue. And it's literally you have to just sit your bum in a chair and do it. And that's the most important advice that I've ever gotten for writing is just do it. But for me, one of the hardest things about writing a full-length novel is that muddy middle. After the excitement has worn off, you know how you want it to end, but all this stuff has to happen to move that story from point A to point B. And it just gets really hard to get through that. So.
When I wrote Uncontrolled Variables, I had all of the action scenes, a ton of dialogue. I was really happy. And then it's like, this is a disjointed mess. How do I get from here to over
exactly.
here?
So with a short story, you don't have that. Yeah, you don't. You get the beginning and the end.
Maybe that's why people write short story collections that are tied together.
So, and that's true for my nonfiction works, too. So those are collections of smaller sightings, like smaller ghost stories, or they're all based on what you found in the newspapers. Those are already predetermined, so I just have to tell them in an interesting way. So I don't really have to, but it also makes me really miss the creative part, and I'm excited to get back to more of that, where you get to actually make up what happens to your characters and you don't have to stay to that script. Yeah, so what's next in your series? Once you turn in your book that's due Thursday.
That is book 9. Book 10 is Uncontrolled Variables, finally, the very first one I wrote.
Do you have an outline, or how do you come up with your story for each one? Do you have it preconceived and you work through the points?
No.
So tell me how that works.
I'm falling into the category of a pantser. Yep. You know, we have pantsers who are just completely see to pants it, and then you have people who have a detailed outline so that they're never surprised by their books. And then there's the in-between where I start writing with an absolute blank page. I know who has to still be alive at the end of the book because he's supposed to be in the next book. Everybody else is a target. And then I start writing until I'm far enough that I know enough that I can start planning out the scenes that have to happen later. And then I can go back and fill them in. When I wrote Uncontrolled Variables, I didn't do it linearly. I did it, you know, all the action scenes, and then and that, mm-hmm. that made it hard. Now I'm doing it really linearly, and I'm trying to just go from first word to the end and learn as I'm going. The characters do find ways to surprise me.
I think I'm the opposite. I'll sit down with a plan. I'll know how I want to start. I'll know what the mystery is. And then I know how I need it to end. But the middle is kind of fair game and anything can happen. And I think one of the joys for me in writing fiction is that you don't always know what your characters are going to do when you sit down to write that day. So it becomes almost more fun than watching a television show because my characters will surprise me every minute. But I've learned that you get going in that moment. And I did a lot of my fiction writing. I had little kids at home, so I had very limited time to do that. And I almost work better when I don't have a lot of time because you can't procrastinate. You have to do what you're supposed to do in that moment. One of the things that I learned from my own process that I need to do is if I'm going through and I'm creating all these scenes, if I'm in a really good rhythm, before I walk away from that page, I need to type out what's going to happen next so that when I come back, I have a starting point. And the other thing is that when I wrote that first book, I made a lot of mistakes. I would get really excited to write something that was going to come next, so I wanted to get to the exciting part, so I jumped ahead. And what happened then was when I got done, I figured I would get it all on edit. Like, I would know what I needed to do to fill in all those gaps. So when I got done, I thought I was done, but I had all these holes in my manuscript that had all these unfinished parts. And I didn't realize that your editing brain is very different than your creating brain. You're in a completely different mind space when you're editing something versus when you're creating characters. What I thought would be easy was really, really hard because I was in an editing brain where I wanted to just keep reading and fixing, but I couldn't because now I had this whole scene that I had to go back and recreate. So that was one of my rules that I made for myself, was that I could not skip parts. I have to make myself, even if I'm stuck, even if I've got some writer's block, I force myself through that. Even if I'm writing, I don't know what to write here. I just make myself keep going. So how do you deal with those writer's blocks?
I start something new. That's my favorite form of writer's block, is to just start something new. I have another brainstorm. It's like, oh, this is so good. I got to get this one started.
So do you go back and finish then?
Yeah, eventually. I have a lot of things that I will be writing for a long time trying to finish what I've started.
We'll be back for more Masters of Mystery after a word from our sponsors.
I'm the threat that's already inside the house. In the closet, under the bed, in the car. But I don't want your money or your TV. I can't be scared away or negotiated with. I'm patient and quiet. I don't sleep. You can't call the cops on me. You can't even see me. I'm the threat of family fire. And as long as your guns aren't stored securely, I'll be there. Protect your family. Secure all your guns. Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. That's endfamilyfire.org. A public service announcement brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
Breaking sports radio show news coming across the ticker. In a move for the ages, 105.5 WIRI has traded for playmakers. Join us 4 to 5 Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. Hit us in the numbers by calling with your sports takes and feelings. We'll have James, Randy, Michael, and Seth bringing you local sports coverage and news that you won't hear anywhere else. Thanks to our friends at Quality Plus Printing and Family Natural Foods. Be heard 4 to 5 every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on 105.5 WIRI's newest roster edition, Playmakers. We speak sport. You know that tune. You're a star. You know stuff. Why not win stuff? Maybe it's stuff about TV or movies, but still, you shine at useless information. And WFHR and Culver's want to reward you.
Welcome back.
Join the morning show Fridays for a chance to win one value basket and a kid's meal. Be our next superstar with Culver's Star of the Day every Friday at 97.5 FM WFHR. From newspaper to radio to magazine to podcast, the way we get our information has grown, and now so has Midday Magazine. Our longtime beloved show has grown to become the Rapids Report. Now exclusively available online, listen at 4 p.m. Monday through Friday, where it's streaming at WFHR.com. Catch up on previous episodes and spread the word. Midday Magazine is now the Rapids Report, streaming weekdays at 4 at WFHR.com and wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Beth, host of The Kitchen's Open. Have you ever found yourself asking,
what's a good recipe for cookies my kids will love?
How do I avoid giving my guests food poisoning?
How would a restaurant chef prepare this meal?
If so, then tune into The Kitchen's Open, the show within the morning show each Monday morning at the start of the 10 o'clock hour. I'll tackle topics, teach techniques, or tell you what to do or not to do when it comes to cooking or the kitchen. I'll also bring you interviews with local chefs and restaurant owners. The Kitchen's Open. We'll tell you something good.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best. What about those round trips that you plan in advance, which are perfect on your way there and perfect on your way back? Or those meetings with friends for which you make a group chat 3 months before so that nobody or anything is missing? Or your daughter's first birthday party? You planned it with such dedication that instead of the first, it felt like our quinces. The same way you plan each detail for those moments. Start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Sign up for local weather and emergency alerts. Prepare an emergency kit. And make a family communications plan. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
It's no mystery where you find the best munchies. It's under the Old Dutch windmill at your favorite snack store. For over 90 years, Old Dutch Foods has proudly delivered taste sensations to families throughout the Midwest. Old Dutch is a Minnesota-made, family-owned company committed to quality and flavor that brings everyone together. Whether you're enjoying a gathering with loved ones or reading your favorite mystery, Old Dutch snacks make every moment special. Join us in celebrating the flavors that have delighted loyal fans for generations. Old Dutch. Quality lives here.
Welcome back, sleuths and savants. It's time to rejoin Masters of Mystery.
Now, you write nonfiction.
I do. I write a lot of nonfiction. I started writing with ghost stories, though. As a lawyer, I was always around really logical and rational people all through law school. But when I was a little girl, I was always really fascinated by ghost stories. I was always the kid at the campfire that couldn't get enough. But what I was looking for in a story wasn't something that I could find. I always wanted to hear more about the ghost. You always hear ghost stories, and it's about how scary it is to have a ghost or to see a ghost. But I always thought it would be equally scary to be the ghost. I was raised Catholic, and you have the concept of heaven and hell and purgatory, and if you're supposed to go somewhere when you die, that was scary to me. And you're trying to get help from people. So that was always something that was really scary to me. And I just wanted to explore more about why. Why would a soul not go where they were supposed to? And so when I was around all these logical people, I started getting ideas for creative stories. So my first manuscript that I wrote was about a law student who, I wanted to smash those ideas together. Let's take a character who's trained to think logically and rationally like a lawyer, and then give her something completely irrational that she has to deal with like a ghost, and smash that together and see what happens. So that's how I started writing. The nonfiction books came out around because Adventure Keen is a publisher up north, and they do travel books. And they came to me and my co-author, Jessica Freeberg, and wanted a true story book about Bigfoot. That's a little hard to wrap your head around when nobody's ever caught the guy. We decided that we were going to take a primary source support to that. All of those stories used to get reported in the newspapers going back to the 1800s. So we recreated the monster sightings as if you were there witnessing it, based on what was reported in the newspapers. Because when a publisher is asking you to write a book and promising to pay you money for it, then you just say yes.
Yeah, how many of the sisters in crime who are writing series are doing that because they sold their first book and then the publisher said, this is a series, right? And you all went, of course it is. Yeah.
Is that how you started your series? Tell me about your
series. No, actually it isn't. I woke up from a nightmare shaking in bed. And at that point, I was very heavily into being a guitar player. And the last scene is the guy in the nightmare loses his hands. And I couldn't think of anything a whole lot scarier. So there I am like this going, hey, they're still here. Thank God. But I mutated that particular scene plus a couple of other nightmares and created a character named Jacob Daniels. And I wrote my first novel. I was pretty pleased with it. But I included a bunch of stories in it that happened earlier in his life. So I wanted to make sure I had him right. I went back and started writing those. I started writing Jacob Daniels' life at the age of 5. The first book, he's 25 in the very first one I wrote. So I went back till he's 5 and I started writing forward. I hit 13 and I ended up with an entire novel of things. And that's called First Casualty. From there, I kept working on other things. I wanted to get back to the point where I was having the nightmares, and I wanted to fill everything in there in between. And then George Lucas screwed up the Star Wars movies. I thought Episode 4, the very first movie, was great. It had some issues, but it was great. 5 was also good. 6 was good. There are a few more issues in that. Then he came out with Episode number 1, the fourth movie. And I'm like, man, you blew the entire series. You lost your timeline. You lost all the continuity. You just trashed the whole thing. And it convinced me that I really needed to be careful writing the series and move really slow and make sure I had all of the stuff right. My sister-in-law over here, Vicky, has been my continuity reader. I send her a book and I say, what have I screwed up? You know, and it's like, well, you changed names in the middle of the book, dummy. You know. Yeah, well, I like that one better. Well, except you used it in 3 other books. You can't do that. So I worried about that for a long time. I did some marketing, worked on multiple projects. Kathy and I over here, raise your hand, Kathy, the antenna, the invisible one there. We wrote a book. I went to my writing group. I said, I have too much to do. Who wants to help? She foolishly volunteered. So we wrote a book. And then we started the next one and went, no, that goes in front of the one that's done. I brought in the third book. And she said, no, this is the very first book in the series. And I'm like, okay, now we're in trouble. So we worked on that one. We got it. And then a friend of ours told us we needed to enter it in the Freddie Awards, put on by the Florida chapter of the Mystery Writers of America. And somehow we got to be a finalist on the thing. And they invited us down, and we got to pitch the book to agents, which was really cool. But the criteria for being able to pitch was it actually had to be done. So we wrote, half the book in 3 months? You know, and we just get together and we're missing this and this and this, and then we'd sit down and write. And while I was there, we pitched that. It went nowhere. But while I was there pitching that, I was pitching First Casualty or Uncontrolled Variables, depending. I mean, I could never decide which one I was supposed to be marketing. Should I start marketing with the first book I wrote or the first book in the series? I went back and forth. And I just kept writing the whole time. So I went to BoucherCon when I was in Minneapolis in 22, first time I'd been to that. And I attended a panel discussion on small presses. Actually, I think they called them micro presses. And one of the guys said a lot of things I really liked. I actually chased him down the hall after the thing. Told him what I had. He's like, I think you should send it in. So I'm like, no, this is absolutely brilliant. I know it's brilliant. I wrote it. So I sent it in, and we went on a European cruise. So every time when it's like, okay, it's late in America, I'd look at my phone. It's like, why aren't they calling? Turns out they all had COVID. So I got back in October. We started talking. We actually started negotiating. They got sick again. So January, I signed the contract. This is January 23. And they said, we'll take the first 3 books, and then we'll take the second 3 if the first 3 do okay. I was far enough ahead that I submitted the first 3 books on March 1st. And they took advantage of that. And we ended up publishing 6 books in 9 months. It was brutal. So now I've got them only going at the rate of a book a quarter. That's so much better. That's why I'm in trouble on Thursday. But that's how that came about. I am traditionally published. In Too Deep, I couldn't sell them on that one because the timing is wrong. So I actually started a company and published that. So I'm an independent publisher as well, as if I didn't have enough to do.
So I think that brings up a good point. When you're writing, I always tell other authors that when you're writing, you need a plan A and a plan B and a plan C. And I think I'm on double Z by now because I had a pitch session too. And I think when you finish that first manuscript, it's just such an amazing feeling, like you finished something. Except my mistake was that I didn't know it wasn't actually done because I hadn't had it edited. But I was so excited to start the second idea that I jumped into that. And I went to a mystery writers conference, and I too had a pitch session, and it's like speed dating for agents, and you have to go sit in front of each agent. And there were 3. This was in England. I was living in Belgium at the time. We lived there when my kids were really small. My ex-husband was there for work. And I show up, and I'm thinking, like, I finished my book, and I have the second one halfway done. I'm in good shape because the woman next to me waiting to pitch was wearing flip-flops and hadn't even, like, she had just an idea that she was going to go in and pitch. I'm like, I've got this. Like, how am I not walking out of here with an agent? And I think your ego can hit you upside the head really fast when you're doing something like that, and mine certainly did. I sat down in front of the first one, and it was my story, the law student and the ghost and all of this. And I sit down in front of the first guy, and he says, he was from Ireland, and he said, I'm Catholic. I could never represent anybody that writes ghost stories. And I'm like, well, I'm Catholic too. But okay, so I'm like, okay, we have 8.5 more minutes, so what do you want to talk about then? Because like, you clearly don't want my book. So then I go to the next one, and she says, great concept, but this is a young adult novel. You need to rewrite the whole thing as a young adult. Change up your characters. Rewrite the whole thing as a young adult novel. Yep. I was like, okay. So at this point, I'm feeling very stunned. And then I go to the next agent who was from a publishing house in London and was very well respected. And she sits across from me and she says, so backing up, I need to tell you that my character in that is... the ghost in that story was actually based on a personal experience. My ex-husband lost his best friend in a murder right after college, and that's when we actually met at his funeral. So then started dating. So it was very personal. It was a very personal story that I had turned into a mystery. And she sits across from me and she says, I just don't believe that anything could have ever happened. And the one thing she was pointing out was actually the true thing. And I burst into tears because I'm a huge empath, and that's what I do when I'm in confrontation. And I just lost it, because here I had walked in thinking I was so confident about all of this, and I walked out so defeated. And I remember just crying to her, but that's the one thing that's true. And I think the look on her face kind of made her realize she was never going to tell anybody that again. So I walked out of there with my tail between my legs and had to kind of regroup. And I decided the best advice I got from that day was to rewrite the novel as a young adult, because that was the most constructive feedback I'd had that whole experience, which I did. And it was crap, because you can't take characters that you've created in a certain time and space and then back them up 10 years, because all the things that are happening to them don't make sense anymore. But that one misstep led me to the best writers group I have ever found, and they got me on track. They helped me fix a lot of my issues with point of view, a lot of my issues with dialogue, and I just became a better writer working with them. And then when we moved back to the United States, I had signed with a literary agent who was not Dawn, but I was looking to replace my writer's group. And that's actually how I found my co-author, Jessica Freeberg. So you never know when you're doing something like this, what the universe has planned for you. And in my experience, it was so not what I was thinking, but I'm pretty happy with the way the path has gone.
We'll be back after a word from your local station.
Hi everyone, Seth here from Seth Faces the Music. You know, being the host of the award-winning second greatest radio show in the state of Wisconsin can be a lot of work. I have to come up with new themes all the time. So in the interest of clarity, here are some topics I will not be using in upcoming episodes.
Mittens, tinfoil, gastric bypass surgery, window treatments, 17th century Japanese art, outhouses, bowler hats, spam, clog dancing.
Seth Faces the Music, every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. only on WFHR.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariana. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I think the advice I would give is you don't need to know all the answers. The craziest thing was believing that your dad knew everything. So as a dad, you felt like you had to know everything. You had to get everything right. It's okay to make mistakes. As long as it's coming from love, then, you know, it kind of starts to work itself out. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when. Don't find yourself saying,
I'll trust water bottles and a flashlight to save the day, but I'll be proved wrong.
With a tornado approaching, I'll realize that I lack a wheelchair-accessible shelter.
When the floodwaters rise, I'll be up in the attic with 20 cans of beans. It's a recipe for disaster.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
As seasons change and years fly by, one thing remains consistent: Old Dutch. For over 90 years, Old Dutch Foods has proudly delivered taste sensations to families throughout the upper Midwest. Old Dutch is a Minnesota-made, family-owned company committed to quality and flavor that brings everyone together. Whether you're enjoying a gathering with loved ones or simply treating yourself, Old Dutch snacks make every moment special. Join us in celebrating the flavors that have delighted loyal fans for generations. Old Dutch. Quality lives here.
Welcome back. It's time to rejoin Masters of Mystery.
The editing part, though, is really tough. You're absolutely right. How you have to kind of change which brain you're using. One of the problems I have is I'll bring up a document, and there's a glaring error right there. How did you miss that the other 12 times you looked at this page? That's always hard for me. The question I have asked almost every writer I've met is, how do you know it's done? I've gotten a lot of really bad answers. Andre Debuse III, one of his books got made into an Oscar-winning movie, and I mean, he's done really well. And I asked him that, and he's like, well, it's simple. You find an editor, and they'll tell you if it's done or not. I think you're in a little different category than I am. I think you can get away with that stuff. So, yeah, that's always been a real struggle with me. I feel really fortunate that my publisher has provided me with an editor who I think is pretty dang good. I've certainly learned a lot from her. To the point, I think my writing is cleaner before I send it to her in the first place. So it's been really helpful. Where do your inspirations come out of your fiction?
Let's see. For fiction, I'm really inspired by history. I love the idea that with a ghost story, you can take something that happened and you can pull the past into the present. Really passionate about preserving some of our darker history to make sure that it's not forgotten or whitewashed over. I like being able to tell some of those darker tales sometimes, especially in my nonfiction work. We've done that with our ghost story books. If a place is haunted, it's usually for a reason. And a lot of times one of the reasons is that something really bad happened there, or we didn't always treat people with the respect and dignity that they deserve. Some of our institutions, and you know what you know, and that's always evolving. What we thought was cutting-edge technology and treatment for the mentally ill wasn't always the best way to do that. So you've got a lot of historical properties that are carrying a lot of heavy energy. That's always a source of inspiration for me, is to tell that story.
You know, I couldn't write, like, for example, historical fiction. I certainly couldn't do historical romance. It's all too much research for me.
I do get sucked into the research rabbit holes.
Well, and I try not to do that. I try really hard to keep it a little more current, so that at least I know it's within my lifetime. I kind of know what happened, and I can kind of keep pieces together. I also have a pretty good knowledge of pop culture and music and stuff, so I always have some of that stuff to pull from. But even knowing that much, I can still get sucked down the rabbit hole. The other day I was looking for something on a drummer, and 2 hours later I had followed his entire history. I needed one sentence. So if I was doing historical fiction, you write historical fiction, I'd be down such a rabbit hole, I'd have to travel. This one takes place in Gettysburg. I guess I better go there. You know, how do you avoid that? Yeah, or don't you?
Go.
Okay.
That was going to be one of my questions for you guys. I mean, Natalie, it sounds like you've gone some amazing places physically to do things.
Yep.
Obviously, there's lots of ways of exploring. What are your favorite rabbit holes or research things you've done?
Well, I'm part of a group called Ghost Stories, Inc., and it's a little bit of a different twist on the idea of a paranormal investigation. We will go investigate a place to find the inspiration behind that, with the idea that if you're going to write about something scary or creepy, then go sit in a scary, creepy place so that you can write about it from a different perspective and actually feel what your character might be feeling. That's been a lot of fun for me, to go explore different things. You never know what you're going to end up using in a story. My daughter's a figure skater, and she was skating in Colorado Springs last week, and my kids kind of roll their eyes because they know that if I'm at a soccer tournament or a skating event, the first thing I do when I get to town is look up what's haunted and then have to fit that in somewhere. I've toured a lot of haunted museums that way, like in the name of looking for locations and location scouting for Ghost Stories, Inc., or I was part of a pitch for a paranormal television series a couple years ago, and I was going and scouting a lot of locations. So just to be able to go see some of this and stand in that history. And now when I started writing these stories, I didn't know that I was sensitive to this energy. And now that I do know that, that adds a whole different level of experience to going and visiting some of those places. So
I learn lots of things about as many things as possible, but only enough to be dangerous. It gives me what I need, and then I can start writing from there. But I find information and inspiration to be around me all over the place. We did a vacation this last year in Ireland, and I went there with the intention, I didn't take a computer, but I went there with the intention of finding two places to leave a body. And I was, 2 days into the trip, and I already had 4 new novels started. It's tough. You just got enough information, and it just feeds into the thing. One of them will be in the Daniel series, and in the Psychic Guardian Angel series, and then there's others that just want to be written, so...
So for those of us who are ghost curious, yes, how would we go and see a haunted house and not risk dark energy coming to us?
Well, I think you get what you give. So if you're going in with a positive attitude, like attracts like. So it's all about your intention. And I think the most important thing to remember when you're working with ghost energy is that we're the ones with the human body. So our energy field is going to be infinitely stronger than anything else that's out there. So to kind of put your fear in check with that and just remember that you have the power and the ability to protect your own space. And I like to use Violet from the Incredibles movie as my example. We all have the ability to put up that force field bubble around our energy field. And if you can command that nothing but light and love is allowed in that space. So my favorite place to go to experience something where is the Palmer House Hotel in Sauk Center. They do regular ghost tours and historical tours where you can go and stay at the hotel for the weekend and sign up for the tour. You don't even have to be there for a ghost hunt. You can just go sit in the... Some of my best paranormal experiences there have happened just sitting in the lobby and just paying attention and tuning in and seeing what happens. So that's one of the best places. There's a lot of ghost walking tours in the area that you can go on. I used to do the paranormal events at Four Paws. And that's, just go sit and have dinner somewhere like that. And you can just feel what you feel and just take it in. Anytime you're in a historical place like that, I think there's a possibility. And one of the things that's happening with our energy right now is that the veils are thinning. Our vibration is raising. So the veils are thinner than they've ever been before. So I think it's easier to have a paranormal experience than it used to be.
We went to the Palmer House one time. My mom grew up in Sauk Center. I spent, I was there many times through the years. Had never been to the Palmer House. So we went there this last summer. We had a really nice lunch.
Mm-hmm. I lied. There's one bonus question. I'm sorry. I missed her hand earlier. So I'm going to let her ask real quick.
Okay. Yep. You've just explained difference in the ghost and the spirit. My question is... My daughter, when she was young, had a very detailed imaginary friend. Yes. Where do you think this all fits in?
So I also had an imaginary friend when I was a little girl. Her name was Darnie. And I was about 3 or 4. And Darnie went with me everywhere. And this was a story that survived my childhood. We all have those stories that everybody told about you when you were little that are super embarrassing at parties, and this was one of mine. And the story was that one day my mom asked me where Darnie was, and I told her that she died of a heart attack and had to go. So that was the funny little nugget story that survived. Well, as I started writing in the paranormal and researching, I did a lot of research that said... Kids with imaginary friends often are interacting with a ghost. So I kept going back to my mom. Mom, are you sure I wasn't playing with a ghost? Oh, no, it was just your imagination. And that's what I was told when I was little, that it was just my imagination and there's no such thing as ghosts. I finally got her to admit a couple of years ago that she and my grandmother actually had a conversation about how I was probably playing with a ghost, but they had no idea what to do about it, so they just told me it was my imagination and they pretended it didn't happen. So when my own kids started asking me those questions about energy or voices that they were hearing or experiencing, I was already writing ghost stories, so that wasn't an option for me to tell them that it was just their imagination and there was no such thing. So that's actually also what prompted some of my learning. Like, how do I explain this to my kids so that it's not something they grow up being afraid of? Because in that moment for me, I shut everything down because as a kid, you're hearing that it's just, like, the alternative is scary. The alternative is that the adults in your life can't explain this thing that's happening to you. And that's pretty scary as a child to not understand or know how to deal with that. So
Jacob Daniels would be a reluctant psychic because he can't control it. It just kind of happens to him, which is what was my deal. So one of the things that I think is that most of us have a psychic ability. We don't use it. We don't recognize it. We might be afraid of it. Or in a lot of cases...
Nobody teaches you how to use it.
No, yeah, definitely nobody teaches you how to use it. But also the adults in your world drive it out of you. I think that applies to imagination in every aspect. We make kids grow up too fast. We take the fun out of things. We ruin their imagination. We kill their invisible friends. Embrace the spirit world. Support local booksellers. Support local authors.
On that note, definitely do please stop by Once Upon a Crime, pick up some books, get them signed. Join me in a round of applause to thank our authors tonight.
Thank you all very much. It's been fun.
That's all for tonight, folks. Thanks for joining Masters of Mystery, and please come back next month as we once again converse with some of the world's most celebrated mystery writers in our quest to understand the minds behind the murders. In the meantime, please support your local bookstores, and in particular, buy the books of these authors who have entertained us tonight. Until next time, take the time to hug your kids and read a good book. This is Rob Young signing off.
It's no mystery where you find the best munchies. It's under the Old Dutch windmill at your favorite snack store. For over 90 years, Old Dutch Foods has proudly delivered taste sensations to families throughout the Midwest. Old Dutch is a Minnesota-made, family-owned company committed to quality and flavor that brings everyone together. Whether you're enjoying a gathering with loved ones or reading your favorite mystery, Old Dutch snacks make every moment special. Join us in celebrating the flavors that have delighted loyal fans for generations. Old Dutch. Quality lives here.
Now, as the fog drifts over the moors and cobblestones gleam under the rain-washed lamplight, our guest authors take their final bows. The riddles have been unraveled. The cases are closed. The curtain falls. This has been Masters of Mystery, brought to you by Old Dutch Foods. Signing off until next month, when we will once again dissect the minds behind the murders. Good night and pleasant dreams.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
David Hogg, Democratic National Committee Vice Chair, says, no, we're going to spend $20 million to take out fellow Democrats who are either too old or not voting progressive enough. And Republicans are doing this as well. They don't want any compromise, zero-sum game. I spent 30 years in politics. The best politics are pragmatic. You get 75% of the loaf and you move on.
Catch The Todd Allbaugh Show at its new time, weekdays 2 to 4 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app. Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel.
Ross calling in.
Thanks for your show. I'm just wondering if we're watching or witnessing a legal system that where what we thought was precedent is now going to be sort of cast away.
The reality is the question that you raise about the future and what are the implications when, in fact, the things we understood always to be bedrocks of our community, of our nation, are no longer that.
Amicus, a law review, Saturday mornings from 9 to 11.
We are the keepers of the wild. For more than 80 years, we've been committed to conserving the natural landscapes that define our nation. Nothing is more important than maintaining wild spaces for adventurers to explore and wildlife to thrive. We are America's hunters and target shooters, Together with firearm, ammunition, and archery manufacturers, we've supported the conservation of more than 36 million acres of American wildlands. For more information, visit OutdoorStewards.org.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Linda Kenyon. More than 1,300 employees at the National Institutes of Health have lost their jobs since January. It's part of the Trump administration's downsizing through the Department of Government Efficiency, or the DOGE. Sharon Alfonsi reported about the cuts on CBS's 60 Minutes.
The confusion in Bethesda has also paralyzed many of the 2,500 universities and institutes that rely on the NIH to help fund their research. So far, nearly 800 grants have been terminated, some on HIV and AIDS, trans health, and COVID-19, after researchers were told their work was no longer an agency priority.
Laura Broom is concerned about cuts to Alzheimer's research.
This is not a partisan issue. Disease doesn't know your party affiliation or your socioeconomic status, and everyone in America